Greetings and welcome to today's webinar presentation on insights from the author, Citizen Justice, the environmental legacy of William O. Douglas, public advocate and conservation champion. Before I pass the mic over to our presenters, I have a few housekeeping items that I like to bring to the audience's attention. For attendees who would like to enable closed captioning for the session, click on the CC icon along the control panel. To submit questions for our presenters, click on the Q&A icon. Our presenters will do their best to answer questions when appropriate, but plan to have a devoted Q&A portion at the end of the panel. Now, I'd like to turn the virtual mic over to Judge Gelpy for speaker introductions.
Hey, good afternoon to all, or good morning. Some of you are in the West Coast, and welcome to this webinar. I'm excited to be here, and I'm very happy my colleague from the Ninth Circuit, Judge McKeown, is here with me. So let me briefly introduce her. And she was appointed to the Ninth Circuit in 1998, and she just held her 25th year anniversary. She is a native of Wyoming and a graduate of Georgetown University Law Center, where she also holds an honorary doctorate of law. She has engaged in numerous rule of law initiatives with both judges and lawyers alike, and has lectured extensively on international law, human rights law, intellectual property, ethics, judicial administration, constitutional law, just to name a few. She was in private practice for approximately 25 years at Perkins Coie, I believe was the name of the firm, in D.C. and also in Seattle, and she was a partner. She was also, before that, a White House fellow, special assistant at the White House, and also for the Secretary of the Interior during that time. And she was the former president of the Federal Judges Association, which I'm a member as well. And when she's not busy writing a book or articles, she chairs the Ninth Circuit's Workplace Committee and is a member of the Judicial Conference's Judicial Conduct and Disability Committee. I would also like to, in his memory, Justice Douglas, give you a very short bio, which we will talk about him. So he's popularly remembered as the longest tenured justice in history, and most of us remember him as a civil libertarian, prolific writer of books, and the author of Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, which established the constitutional right to privacy. However, as we will come to learn from Judge McKeown, he was more than a bright legal mind. He grew up in Washington, trekking the landscape surrounding Mount Adams and Mount Rainier, and he also left behind a legacy as environmental champion and conservationist. He's a graduate of Columbia Law School, who trampolined from corporate law to academia at Columbia and later Yale Law School, and later chaired the Securities and Exchange Commission before being nominated to the Supreme Court. There, he authored his perhaps most powerful dissent in Sierra Club versus Morton, in which the majority held that Sierra Club lacked standing to sue to stop a development in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Today, we remember Justice Douglas through his legal writings, but of greater impact, as the judge will let you know throughout this webinar and makes it very clear on his book, we should also remember him without his robe as a citizen justice. So, Judge McKeown, good afternoon and welcome to be here. And I will start by asking, what interested you specifically in the life and work of Justice Douglas and so more in writing this wonderful book, which I have read? Was it based on your own life experience? I know you've lived cross country from East Coast, from Washington, D.C. to Seattle, and now you live in San Diego. Do you feel somehow because of that and your birthday, you grew up in Wyoming, do you feel any connection to Justice Douglas?
It's a great question. I did not imagine, having become an appellate judge, that I would be writing a book on a Supreme Court justice, because we are plenty busy, particularly in the Ninth Circuit, with our caseload. So it was really more of a serendipity. I was out in Wyoming at the Murie Ranch, and the Muries were longtime conservationists in Alaska and around the country. He was president of the Wilderness Society, Olaus and Marty Murie. So I was out at the ranch and someone said, hey, we have a letter here in our archives from Justice Douglas to the Muries. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, of course, as a lawyer. So I read the letter and basically Douglas wrote to these conservationists and said, you should give your ranch to conservation and leave it to the Park Service, which I thought was pretty audacious on his part. But more interesting, I thought, how did this Supreme Court justice from D.C. know these rather humble conservationists who had worked in Alaska, Wyoming, and other places? How did he know them? And so that got me going a little bit to do a little research. And little by little, I did a little more research. And then I realized, oh, there is actually a story to tell here, not only about Douglas and how he knew these conservationists from Wyoming, but his larger life as what I called a citizen justice. And I knew about him before, of course, having practiced law in Washington State. Douglas was an icon. He was the justice assigned to the Ninth Circuit. And so if you had an emergency petition, you would present it to the justice. But he was also a hiker and a climber, as I am. And so I felt some affinity to him. And interestingly, after I graduated from law school, he was still alive. And someone had said once he died, we should buy his cabin. He had a cabin out in the Cascades Mountains. And so we should make it into an historical location. And of course, we thought, well, that's a great idea. There were just two problems. One, we didn't have any money. We were young lawyers. And two, the cabin wasn't for sale. But kind of in a very strange ending of the circle, one of my former partners, when the cabin did come up for sale some 5-7 years back, he bought the cabin and he's kept it exactly the same as Douglas. And that cabin is important because every year when the Supreme Court ended its term, Douglas would jump on the plane and go out to Goose Prairie, Washington, near Yakima, where the cabin is. And he not only would get on a plane, but he often would leave before the term was done, which irritated his colleagues somewhat. He would say, I've written my dissents, I've written my opinions, I'm done. And, you know, contact me if you will. Well, there was no internet and contacting wasn't so easy. And there was even a situation during the summer where someone needed to have an emergency petition. So they marched out to the cabin and they were all dressed up in suits and ties like lawyers would be. And he said, what are you doing out here dressed like that? You're not dressed like that in the wilderness. And they said, well, they had this emergency petition. He said, okay, I'll take it. And I'll leave it the answer on the log tomorrow. So they came back still dressed in suits and ties the next day. And the answer was, petition denied. So for me, it really was a total serendipitous situation where the more I researched, the more interesting I got in the topic. And people said, you should write a book. And I said, well, I write opinions. I'm plenty busy. But I did write the book. I primarily sat down during COVID and wrote it.
Well, great. And Judge, you mentioned that Justice Douglas was a prolific hiker, and we'll get into that a little later on. But I also want to note that you were on the first American expedition to Mount Shishapanga in Tibet. So in a sense, after having written the book, I assume you identify yourself a bit more with him and his hikes.
Well, that's true. That's true. I was in a big avalanche at about 22,000 feet, and I survived, obviously. And then I decided to curtail my hiking career. But I did identify with him because he was an adventurer at heart. And that is a spirit that I internalize and also understand from him.
Great. Well, tell us a little bit about how you went into doing the research for the book. If you look at the acknowledgments, you basically went from coast to coast gathering information. So what sources did you look to, and who do you look to for help?
Well, the first thing I did was at the Miri Ranch, and later I became chair of the Miri Ranch Committee which is part of the Teton Science Schools where I'm on the board, that is, in fact, that ranch was left to the National Park Service as a tribute to conservation. So they have an archives. I went through there and I realized, well, I needed to look at Douglas's material. So I went to Washington, D.C., and anytime I was in Washington, I would trump down to the Library of Congress to the archive division on Saturdays, Fridays afternoons. I spent hours at the Library of Congress, and all of his papers are there. Douglas was a pack rat. He kept every Christmas card, every holiday card. He was a big, prolific correspondent, and his assistants were forever typing letters to people. So there was a lot to go through, but it was fascinating to actually have a peek into his life through the Library of Congress. But that then led me to other locations. Of course, he had relations with Roosevelt, so I had to look at Roosevelt archives, the LBJ, Lyndon Johnson down in Texas, also JFK in Boston and the archives there, because those were the presidents that he straddled. And I also looked at university libraries, University of Wyoming, where there is a Murie collection, University of Washington, where there's a whole collection on conservation. Then I went to the Berkeley Library, where the Sierra Club archives are. I went to the Denver Library, where the Wilderness Society archives are, and Yale Library. So I really was all over. Most of those I went to in person, kind of on my own dime, just because once I got going, I was propelled to go to the next archive. And maybe that's also what I love about being an appellate judge. I love the record. I love to dig into the record. And here I was digging into his record after the fact, just to see what kind of story there was. And the great part is they didn't have the internet. So all of the correspondence, all the memos are preserved intact. And that's really one of the joys of being able to do this kind of archival research. I really enjoyed the research. And at one point, I didn't necessarily know I would write a book. So I just kept researching, which was very fun. And then I realized, well, I either should quit researching and write a book or just quit researching. So I wrote the book.
Well, that's great. Well, now let's talk a little. Let's start talking about Justice Douglas. Of course, he's the subject of your book. And as you explained early on the book, could you share with the audience how did his passion for the environment come to be originally?
I think it originally started when he was a kid. He was a scrawny kid and skinny, and according to various sources, he had polio. Others have disputed it, but there's no doubt that he had some disease, and he was a scrawny kid, and he was bullied. So he went out into the wilderness outside his house in the Cascade Mountains, and there he started to hike and to build up his strength. And he could see Mount Rainier from up there. He could see Mount Adams, both two glacier peaks in Washington, both of which I've climbed, and of course he climbed. And I think that got his interest in the outdoors. And then he started being interested in details. He was interested in wildlife. He was interested in plants. He collected through all of his travels various plants, which he pressed, and some of them you can see either at the Murie Ranch or at the Library of Congress. So he really, I think he saw the wilderness as his cathedral. That was his spiritual life, as he explained. And he writes fairly eloquently, but sometimes, you know, a little mushy about his life in the wilderness, his spiritual rejuvenation. So I think really it began as a child and continued throughout his life.
And he was the author of several books, even way before he got to Supreme Court, before he became famous. But he wrote several books about the environment, prior to that. Can you talk a little about those books?
Sure. Well, he wrote 50 books in all, which is really pretty staggering. It was like kind of the rate of, you know, a couple books a year during the height of his writing. And they range. Of course, when he was an academic, he wrote some books on reorganization and business. But then he started writing books like The Pacific, My Pacific Northwest Wilderness, which chronicled all of his hikes and the flora and fauna of the Northwest. He wrote three volumes on a biography. And he also wrote a book that many people remember called Of Men and Mountains. And that came about, actually, he was out riding a horse up in the Cascade Mountains, and he had an accident. And the horse, he rolled down the mountain, and then the horse, all thousands of pounds, rolled onto him. And he broke almost all of his ribs. And so as he was recovering, and he was on the court at the time, he began writing that book, Of Men and Mountains. And anyone who loves the mountains and hiking has read that book. But then he went on to write books about, one I remember is on the High Himalayas. And if you've ever seen that movie, Rear Window, you see Grace Kelly reading a book. And if you look closely, you'll see she is reading a William O. Douglas book on the High Himalayas. He wrote another book that comes to mind called Farewell to Texas. And he did a lot of work with environmentalists in Texas, and he was very concerned that the degradation of the environment was going to be the end of some of these amazing places in Texas. Now, he was friends with Lady Bird Johnson and Lyndon Johnson, and particularly Lady Bird hated that title. She asked him to change the name of the book, but he didn't change the name of the book. He kept it as, you know, Farewell to Texas. So he wrote also a Wilderness Bill of Rights, fashioned after the Bill of Rights to our Constitution. And then he would write other books, particularly on his travels. He was, you know, very early in the 50s, he was going to China. He was going to Tibet, Red China, as they called it at the time. He was in Russia. He was in India. Sometimes he was hiking, and sometimes he was just exploring. So he was a real adventurer and was forever writing books. Some people said he wrote a lot of books because you could actually get paid back then in royalties, which doesn't happen so much now. And he had several marriages leading to several divorces leading to alimony, and that he had to keep up with that, which was hard to do on a justice's salary. But he definitely was a prolific writer, and he wrote by hand on these big yellow legal sheets. So when you go to the Library of Congress, you can see the drafts, not only of his opinions as they change through various iterations, but you can see the drafts of his books and how he was thinking and how he was writing. He kept little notebooks for every hike. And in there, he listed everybody who he'd met or was on the hike. And then he would list various snippets about what he saw or what he did or where they went. And those little black notebooks, which I finally was able to decipher his handwriting after much looking, are, you know, a very interesting insight into this guy.
Well, that's excellent. Now, let's start talking a little bit about his legal background. He went to Whitman College, which was in Washington State, a small school, and then he decided to go to the East Coast, to Columbia. So after graduating Columbia, what did he do, and what was his path ultimately to the Supreme Court?
Right. Well, after he was in Columbia Law School, he worked briefly for Cravath, Swain & Moore, as it's now known. And he was bored with the law in a private law firm. So he decided, well, maybe he should go back to Washington State. So he went back for a while, and he had married someone he had met there, because after college, he actually went back to teach in the high school. So he goes back to Washington State, And he actually interviewed with my old firm. And, you know, they offered him something like 500 and Cravath offered him something like 5,000. So he thought, well, okay, he'll go back to Cravath. So he went back to Cravath, where he didn't last long. And I thought your verb was fantastic, trampolining from job to job. That is like a perfect description. So he goes back to Cravath and he doesn't like it any better before, even though they pay him a lot of money. So he teaches at Columbia and then eventually teaches at Yale. And when he was at Yale, as I said, he was basically in the business world, which surprises people because, of course, he's known as a civil libertarian. So he was not teaching constitutional law and courses like that. But one thing that bothered him is that he felt that law professors asked questions and they never answered them. And so that was kind of the beginning of this legal realist movement. And he wanted more concrete answers. And finally, he got the call to come to Washington to do a study at the SEC, which was a newly formed administrative agency. FDR was the president. And so he does this study, and he's not there very long before he becomes a commissioner of the SEC. And at that time, Joseph Kennedy was the chair of the SEC, and really he became a patron for Douglas. And Douglas begins to meet a lot of people in Washington. So when, after Kennedy exit and time goes by, then Douglas becomes the chair of the SEC at a very young age. And that's when, you know, while he's there, he's playing poker with the president way into the night. And he and FDR got along really quite well. And he's going to embassy parties and hobnobbing with all the glitterati of Washington. And at one point, he gets a call from the White House saying the president wants to see you. And so he actually was out playing golf. He, of course, rushes down to the White House, and he's really worried because he thinks the president is going to ask him to be the head of the Federal Communications Commission. And particularly, the president said something like, I'm going to offer you a job that's a little bit like being in jail. And he thought, oh no, the FCC. And he did not want to be head of the FCC. And then the president says, I want you to be on the Supreme Court. So that's 1939. He's 40 years old. And at this point, as we've said, he's practiced law barely. And he's been a law professor. And boom, he's on the Supreme Court. And of course, he gets confirmed in record time, and unlike today. And he then becomes the second youngest justice ever to serve, but the longest serving ever. And of course, he dies, he leaves the court in 1975, and he dies in 1980. So getting on the court was really pretty remarkable given his age and his background, but he obviously had caught the fancy of the president, and the president wanted a Westerner on the court. Now, keep in mind that really the bulk of his life at this point had been on the East Coast. So they quickly are, his supporters are championing him as a man of the West. And he showed the cover of the book at the beginning, and you see that hat. Kind of looks like a floppy Western cowboy hat. But that was kind of his trademark hat for hiking. And there's an expression out West, and that is, are you all hat and no cattle? In other words, are you the real thing? And so his supporters said, yeah, he's the real thing. He really is a Westerner at heart. And that also, I think, helped him get appointed to the Supreme Court, where he then served for all those years.
And how was the composition and judicial attitude of the Supreme Court at that time? We're talking early 1940s.
Right. Well, everybody remembers from history Roosevelt's proposal to pack the court, because during the New Deal, and the court was striking down some of the progressive labor and other legislation, and Roosevelt didn't like that. It became pretty clear that packing the court was not going to work. So at the time that Douglas comes on the court, other people around that time are Black and Frankfurter, who had been a professor, Robert Jackson, Harlan Stone, and Chief Justice was Charles Evans Hughes. So it was very much a Roosevelt court. Douglas really identified with Black, particularly in a lot of First Amendment issues. And so they were, I would say, judicial twins in some ways. He and Frankfurter did not get along. And you would have thought they might, both coming from academia, both being liberal at the time or considered liberal. Frankfurter was close to Roosevelt as well. But there was a real an affirmative animosity there. So Douglas goes on to serve under Earl Warren, and the Warren court was where I think he was very comfortable in his decisions, and then went on the last portion. Warren Burger became Chief Justice in 1969, and so that was the last Chief Justice that he served under. So you saw a changing composition of the court to a degree, but that I think intellectual connection with Black was quite significant.
And when was the first time, or when did he really begin to have, feel that Douglas had an impact at the Supreme Court?
Well, you know, early on, well, one thing I should say is that early in his career, there was a case in which the question was, should federal judges pay income tax? And of course, we wish the answer had been no, but of course we should pay income tax. And in the opinion, which Douglas didn't write, the court said judges are citizens and they too should pay income tax. So at that point, Douglas writes in one of his little books, actually he had a diary at the time, that he was a citizen just like everybody else. And therefore, he could do outside activities just like everybody else, people who are citizens, as long as it didn't interfere with his work on the court. And I would say that's why I called the book Citizen Justice. He took a pretty robust view of what citizen justice was. But, you know, early on, he began to dissent. And over his course of his career, he dissented in almost 500 cases. That's remarkable. But what's even more remarkable is that in 45% of them, he was the lone dissenter. So he is a champion. He's a champion dissenter. I mean, others have gone on to be champion dissenters, Stevens, Justice Scalia. But Douglas used to say, well, I only have one soul to save, and that's my own. So he was not somebody who really cajoled, I think, other members of the court to try to reach coalitions like you sometimes see. And to that degree, I think he had an impact on the court. You mentioned Griswold v. Connecticut, privacy, Brady, which we're all familiar with in the criminal law, Terminello, where he struck down a breach of the peace ordinance. But I think he had less of an impact in part because he was a go-it-alone kind of guy. And that, I think, stemmed from way back when he was a kid and out on the trail and, you know, staking out his own position early on. So he could have, I think, had a bigger impact, but he did definitely have an impact, and particularly in the environmental area.
Very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about the 1940s when he first made it to the court and about the social, political, and legal life of Supreme Court justice. Was giving advice to more than one president, senator, agency heads, the norm? And what about his tinkering with a presidential run at one time while at the Supreme Court?
Well, it turns out that being the so-called advisor to the president was not just Douglas, but a number of others. Some people have justified that saying, well, look, we were in the war, and therefore we had justices appointed to certain war boards. We had justices, talking about what he should do militarily, about what he should do with, social services. So there were a number of justices who were advising the president. And then, of course, we had at the end of the war, Justice Jackson, who left the Supreme Court kind of on a unofficial leave of absence to become the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg. And that was a very watershed event, of course, in international law. But looking back, and if you think about the separation of powers, he was not even a justice on the court. He was the prosecutor on the court, which was, very interesting. So you saw a little more of that. It then kind of tapered off, I think. Frankfurter was somewhat busy with some Zionist activities in particular. Douglas, he kind of got the presidential bee. And it turns out other justices had sort of had that before. And of course, we had Taft, who was both a president at one point and then chief justice. But Douglas was kind of doing it behind the scenes and, of course, always saying, I'm not interested, I'm not interested. And when Roosevelt chose his vice president, the lore goes that there was a piece of paper and it said Truman Douglas, or it said Douglas Truman. Nobody knows. But we do know that Roosevelt chose Truman. And then time passes and Roosevelt dies, which was very hard on Douglas. I mean, he viewed him almost like a father figure because Douglas's father had died when he was quite young. I think he was 6 years old. So then Truman at one point asked Douglas to be vice president, and that was his chance to get into presidential politics. And supposedly Douglas said in his acerbic way, why be number two to a number two? So he turned down the vice presidency. But later, even into the 50s, there was some talk about Douglas for president. And I even have a pin that someone gave me that says Douglas for president. And at one point, he even kind of alluded to Lyndon Johnson that he wouldn't mind being vice president to Johnson. Of course, that was never going to happen. So he was probably the most out there in terms of justices, kind of World War II and post-World War II, that had this presidential bee. And I think once he realizes I'm not going to be president and I don't want to be president, vice president, I think that really also sparked this longer, more extensive interest in the environment.
Okay, and let's move to the environment per se now. How did he start championing the environment while at the Supreme Court? And perhaps, of course, I'm sure you're going to mention in the Sierra Club. And before that, I believe he started using environmental terms, and as you well note in the book, when they had never been used in any opinions.
Right. Well, people knew that he was a hiker, and he was very interested in the outdoors. But even way back, he had quoted Rachel Carson and the concern about pesticides. So he wrote an early case where he warned about pesticides and concerns about pesticides. And then as time went on, whenever there was an environmental case, whether it was a dam or sometimes involving Native Americans, Indians, as they're called in the Supreme Court cases, he would typically side with the Indians if there was an environmental reason, But if it was the Indians versus the environment, then he would side with the fish primarily. And he wrote an opinion that was the first Supreme Court opinion to actually stop a dam. And of course, he proposed what is often proposed. Go back and study it some more. That was a dam in Idaho that ultimately never did get built. So he was very concerned about fish and dams and what the impact was of dams on fish. He was concerned about pesticides, and a lot of that was reflected in this Wilderness Bill of Rights. And I'll come back to Monroe King and Sierra Club Remorton, but once the National Environmental Policy Act was passed, he was very anxious to have the court take one of those environmental cases. And obviously the question was whether the agency had given a close enough scrutiny to the environmental impact. And during his time, he continued to write dissents for failure to grant certiorari because the court didn't grant dissents. And he warned, he said, this needs to come before the court. So his impact there was primarily with respect to his dissents on those NEPA cases. He also, of course, his famous dissent is, do trees have standing? And that's the Monroe King case. There was an area out in California called Monroe King. It's in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And Walt Disney had proposed to build a big ski resort, which would require a highway. Another thing that was a nemesis for Douglas was when you would build highways through the wilderness or even a city. So they needed to build a highway to get there. And the concern of the Sierra Club was that it would completely change this pristine area. So they sued. And although the case is called Sierra Club v. Morton, they didn't have a club member with a concern. They said that the environment, basically the rivers, the mountains, et cetera, had their own standing because that was who would be injured. The district court said, you're right. Ninth Circuit said, no, not so fast. You're wrong. It then goes to the Supreme Court. And in the Supreme Court, Douglas had pretty well landed on a position before argument. And he had at that point kind of been bootlegged an advance copy of a fellow Professor Stone from USC who had written about standing and could nature have standing. So Douglas dissented, of course. The majority said, look, you need to have somebody who was injured. You have to actually have been injured. So go back to the district court. Douglas wrote an incredibly eloquent dissent. And in the dissent, he basically raises this issue of why nature shouldn't have standing, because nature is what is basically impacted. And you've got rivers and trees and mountains. Of course, at the time, that didn't have much traction. And it hasn't had much traction in U.S. federal courts. But interestingly, I think following recent Supreme Court jurisprudence on standing, there'll be another look at nature and rights of nature. It has taken off in two other areas around the world. It's in some constitutions that actually nature has certain rights and can sue. And also in certain municipalities around the United States. So, for example, recently a municipality in Washington gave seals the right to sue. And there's municipalities in California, Pennsylvania, and others where they give nature a right to sue. So if Douglas were to come back now, I think he would probably be smiling and say, okay, I was dissenting for the future, something that we often heard also from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I was dissenting for the future, and the future is starting to come true. So it hasn't come back, you know, with record force in the U.S. federal courts, but it is interesting to look at New Zealand and places in Latin America and see that this idea of nature having rights is actually a reality in the legal world as well.
Well, let's move on now to the part about citizen justice. So outside of the court, let's talk a little about Justice Douglas's crusade to protect the environment and his many walks and the many highways and dams and other constructions he halted ultimately, beginning with the Chesapeake Canal. That one I found very interesting from reading the book because the Washington Post was backing that construction there, and ultimately they hiked with him for many miles, and ultimately the newspaper sided with him. So could you tell us about that walk and the next several others that were really important that you talk about in your book?
Yeah, I think that the CNO Canal was probably what we've documented as being his first environmental protest, if you will. Now, he's on the Supreme Court, it's 1954. The CNO Canal, which runs about 189 miles from Washington up to Cumberland, Maryland, was the site of a proposed development by the Park Service. And they said, let's put in a highway or a large road, and that will be better access for people to access. And Douglas had read about this, and he was outraged. Now, he lived fairly close to that, in fact, in an area called the Palisades, which is, you know, further out than Georgetown. So he wrote an editorial as a justice to the Washington Post that said, you editors are wrong. This is a sanctuary. It's a place of beauty. It's a place that should be preserved, and it should not be turned into a highway or some kind of access that would destroy the environment. And if you want to understand this, you editors of the Washington Post should come hike with me. So the Washington Post editor said, okay, we agree. We'll come hike with you. So they started out at the top of the canal, and Douglas was really pretty strategic. He wanted to end in Washington because there would be the most publicity, of course. So they started at the top of the canal, and the editors went with him, and they definitely did not go 189 miles. There were 9 people who did go 189 miles, and they slept out at night. They'd gotten snowed on. Along the way, there were celebrations, you know, Boy Scouts, various taverns and Wayfair places where they stayed if they weren't camping out. And they finally ended. And among the 9 people was Olas Murie. And that harkens back to the Murie Ranch in Wyoming in the Grand Teton National Park. And the hike at the CNO Canal was where Douglas met Murie. And they would go on several other protest hikes together, but that was really their meeting. So they get back to Washington, and there's the Secretary of Interior. The Park Service is under the Secretary of Interior. And in addition, the Post has all kind of reporters there. And so there's a big hoopla. And Douglas forms a committee, and he does what he often did. He formed what he calls a committee of correspondence, hearkening back to the Civil War when citizens banded together as citizens of correspondence committees. So he starts a committee, and you can imagine who's the chair of the committee, William O. Douglas, Supreme Court Justice. And they even have people from the government, including the Park Service and others, on the committee. And they lobby for years to stop this. Well, finally, the Park Service decides to stop the highway, but then there's a later crusade to make it some kind of national park, and it then became a national historic park. So I know we have some people on the webinar from the East Coast and maybe some from Washington, D.C., where the federal bar is headquartered. We're in Georgetown, the beginning of the CNO Canal. You'll see a bust of Justice Douglas, which is a tribute to him and having saved the CNO Canal. The Park Service now is very proud of the CNO Canal, and they say it's the only park that was actually walked into existence. So we owe that to Douglas. And afterwards, he hiked there almost every Sunday. Very fast hiker, you know, 5-6 miles an hour, very, you know, long legs, tall guy. But once he got going, it was like somebody had lit a fire under him. And he starts going to protest hikes around the country. He went to the Kentucky, and they stopped the Red River Gorge, in fact. There was a forest, an area in Oregon where they stopped the logging. He went to the Olympic Beach, which was the last untrammeled wilderness along the waterfront in the lower 48. And they had a protest hike there. They gathered first at the Supreme Court to discuss how to go about it. And then they hiked on the Olympic Beach. And the Murray, both Mr. and Mrs. Murray were on that hike. Then he went to Alaska. And the Murrays had been very active in Alaska. Olas was an expert in caribou. And he and Marty, his wife, had taken their honeymoon on a dog sled in Alaska. So they were going actually on a scientific expedition, sponsored in part by the New York Zoological Society. And they had a number of known scientists, one of whom was a young guy named George Schaller, who later became quite famous in terms of being a field biologist and botanist. So he was in Alaska and met them up there. And there they plotted how would they save Alaska. And ultimately, the Murrays spread out like missionaries across Alaska, and they created coalitions with hunters, with the natives and others. Douglas went back to Washington, and it's been said that, you know, he worked his magic in Washington. He was tough. One writer said that negotiating with Douglas is like shaving with a blowtorch. And of course, the Murrays were tough, but they had a much softer approach. They were much more not into confrontation, but into coalitions. And ultimately, the Alaska was put into big parts of it to a wilderness status. I had the fortune when I worked for the Secretary of Interior, Cecil Andrus, that Congress passed the Alaska lands legislation, which was a compromise with logging and industry and natives and the fisheries and the conservationists and the environmentalists. So basically, he basically walked all over America protesting. He was the first justice to use the word environmental in the way we use it now. Nobody thinks twice about talking about an environmental movement or an environmental interest. And he first used it in 1972, which was, you know, very early. So I would say these walks were fairly significant. And he was sometimes coordinating with the Sierra Club, sometimes with others. And there were some eyebrows raised in that Sierra Club v. Morton case about whether he should have recused himself from that case, given his very close association with the Sierra Club. If you look in the papers, you can see some discussion of that. He ultimately did not recuse himself, as we know, and he dissented in his famous dissent. So I would say that I don't know of any other justice who's basically walked a park into existence or done that kind of public protest. At one point, they were stopping a copper mine, Kennecott Copper, and there often would be protest signs against Douglas, such as "Bird watchers go home," or "We need a highway," or "The miners should prevail here, not the hikers." So you saw a lot of some fairly creative signs, both for and against Douglas. But he was like a Pied Piper to the environmental movement.
Okay. Well, we have about 10 minutes left. I don't see any questions from the audience. So if there's any, please send them over. I'll continue to ask some more shorter questions. But let me ask you, Judge, had Justice Douglas been sitting in the Supreme Court 2023, what could he have done today on and off the court that he did then, what couldn't he be doing nowadays? Or I'm sure he'd be called to Congress quite frequently.
He might. I would say a couple of things have changed, of course. There's much more transparency in the reporting about justices now than there was then. During most of his tenure, there was no Freedom of Information Act. So you couldn't have gone to the agencies and found out that he was lobbying the Forest Service or the Park Service or what he called his America's worst enemy, the Army Corps of Engineers. And there wasn't the internet. So there are a lot of societal differences now. And then finally, I would say, though, that judges and justices then and now are governed by 28 U.S.C. Section 455 relating to the appearance of impropriety. And that was, in effect, that principle back when he was a justice as well. But it's kind of hard. My book is a book about history and what we can learn from history. But I don't want to project that onto today's court and today's environment.
Okay, we have one question, and the question reads, what was the relationship between Justice Douglas and Robert Kennedy?
A great relationship, actually, because President Kennedy asked Douglas to take Robert Kennedy on a couple of trips, which he did, to Russia and then some hiking trips out west. So they were kind of companions in the natural world. JFK, Douglas always said he never slept on the ground or in a tent, so he never understood this stuff. And he was a president for such a short time that although he was concerned about the environment, you know, he didn't have time to make an impact on the environment. So it's a good question.
Okay, let me see. There's another question, and it reads, Judge McKeown, thank you for the amazing chat and Judge Alpine doing such a great job of moderating. Oh, thank you. My question is, how do you think Justice Douglas would have voted on or reacted to the majority opinion in Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife?
Well, that's a decision, as I recall, by Justice Scalia, and it kind of closed the door on a lot of what Douglas would have said, which is we need more access to the courts. And Lujan really laid out an environmental case, the really strict requirements of injury. And so I think Douglas would have reacted negatively to that particular opinion, and you would have seen him in the dissent.
Okay, we have another question. Nowadays, would Justice Douglas promote a more liberal standing test?
Well, I think the answer is yes, for two reasons. He certainly had the most liberal standing test in nature's rights, but he also believed that there should be access to the courts. And his view was that the purpose of the Constitution was to get the government off the backs of little people. So to the extent you were protecting rights of what he would call little people or the downtrodden, and he felt a lot of that personally, having grown up poor in Yakima, Washington, he probably would have been championing a more liberal standing test. That's one you can project forward, I think, pretty well. So it's a very timely question.
Okay. Let's then wrap up. I don't see any more questions. So let me then ask, what will you say is the greatest legacy Justice Douglas left us, and what can we learn about it in today's terms?
Well, if you'll permit me, I'll just read the last paragraph. my book, where I tried to summarize what I think his legacy. Douglas was a legal giant, a genius, a conservation hero, and a public philosopher. He always said he was talking to the next generation. When he looked back on his remarkable journey, he would disparage environmental challenges, but he would delight that his relentless faith did leave the earth more beautiful than when it came. Many rivers are running free, choice pieces of wilderness are preserved, and trees are still standing. I would say that Douglas was an imperfect hero. There is no doubt that he had certain warts and flaws, but from my perspective, it's really important that we go back and we look at our historic, our figures in history to see what can we learn, what can they teach us. And he's written a lot, so he can teach us a lot. But I think he would not be so comfortable in today's world, given where things are.
Well, let me then conclude, and this is how I concluded my book review about your book several months ago, by saying, since you quote yourself, I'll quote myself, just as Dr. Seuss, the lorics, spoke for the trees have no tongues, so spoke Justice Douglas for the environment as citizen justice. Judge McKeown, I really want to thank you for participating this afternoon, more important for writing this amazing book, and I look forward to presenting your next book.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Judge,
all the audience and live audience, and this will be available for future audiences as well. So thank you very much. And Shanice, if there's anything you need to say, it's your turn.
Thank you. Thank you to our presenters for volunteering their time today. Following the session, our brief post-session survey will become available on your screen. We appreciate your feedback as we continue to improve our educational programming and virtual offerings. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.